Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So I think it's kind of dangerous that I was asked to give the Dhamma talk tonight. I've been on retreat for the last 2 weeks, and even when you're on retreat, sometimes, especially if you have some duties or responsibilities in the monastery, you get asked questions or have things you need to pass on. So there still might be a little bit of talking. But I was quite fortunate this year that for quite a few days I didn't even have to speak at all, and so. Kind of worried about giving a Dhamma talk. There's like the dam that's ready to explode. It's like you haven't said anything for 2 weeks, and then also here's your opportunity. So you know, it's kind of scary because we also have to take responsibility for what we say. And so it's a little bit of apprehension. It's also interesting, like just coming off of a retreat or being in retreat, even conceiving things in terms of words. When you stop doing that for a period of time. Especially if you've done retreats for many years, you can get quite comfortable with that. Not that necessarily thinking stops, but actually verbalizing things can stop. I've told the story at least once before, but early on, I had to take a message to one of the senior monks out in the forest who'd been on retreat for a couple of weeks, maybe even like 3 or 4 weeks, and he just had a note to give to him, and then I was supposed to wait for a response, and so I gave the note to the senior monk, and it seemed like it took him a couple minutes to even realize, how to read. He was kind of looking at this piece of paper, kind of strange, and then he finally realized, what it said. He looked at me, and then he's like using hand signals, what do you call it, charades, and he's trying to tell me to go down to the office, and he's like putting his hand against something, and he's pulling, and I was like. Filing cabinet? He's like, yeah, filing cabinet. I was like, folder? He's like, yeah. He couldn't even come up with words. So it was really beautiful to see, actually, the fact that that state of, being in retreat or, being able to be in a state of mind that you're kind of not normally in, for one thing, I look at that just as, seeing impermanence. Like, we can think that, I'm just a type of person whose mind is always crazy and is always thinking or always planning. But, you just change the conditions just slightly, and we can experience a different reality, be in a different space. And so it's good to, for us here, living here in the community, it's really good to have these opportunities of retreat. To take time to experience life in the monastery, just life in general, in a slightly different context. I had a suspicion that I'd be giving the talk tonight, but I'm still not totally sure, how it's going to come out or what I'll totally say. But the last time I gave a talk was, I think it was about 5 or 6 weeks ago, and at that time I was mentioning how I was using artwork as a means of meditation practice. And at the time, I still had, I still do, but at the time I was really just questioning a lot about that in terms of how to do that. And one thing I was looking forward to is that the Christian monastery next door to us, the abbot of the monastery, Father Damien, is an icon painter. And I've known him a little bit. I've never had any extended conversations or, more than just like, one conversation at a time with him. But I did, in the last talk I gave, was, kind of touching story about him, how when I was having some difficulties with a family member, and went and talked to him about it, and just really touching, his response. And so I've always had this, confidence or trust in him as a teacher and as an individual. And I also knew that he was an artist and that he did these the paintings, but I didn't know that he led workshops. So then he mentioned that when we were there for a tour of that monastery with Ajahn Pasano and his mother, And when he found out that I was working with artwork and painting, he invited me to attend the icon workshop. So myself and one of the other monks here went, and it was almost exactly a month ago, I think, that we were there. So it's already starting to fade into the background. But I do find it interesting that I've been putting a lot of time and a lot of effort into sort of investigating or exploring my artwork since that retreat ended, because that gave me a lot of energy and a lot of good ideas. And so it's interesting. I have noticed, I wouldn't say big changes, but I've noticed changes in the way that I see the artwork, or the way I'm working with it, and the way I use it as a meditation. That's changed quite a bit. And I'm actually looking forward to now, in about 2 or 3 weeks, I've been invited to go down to Sebastopol. There's a Tibetan artist there who's doing a 2-story tall Tonka painting. And I've gone online to look at some of the stuff he has up about it, and it's some of the most beautiful paintings I've ever seen. And they're extremely detailed. I'm guessing that some of them are like just the size of the palm of your hand. Some of these Buddha images are really detailed paintings. This thing's like as big as that, one of these walls here. And he's just, completely filled with these kinds of images. And so I think it's taking him like 5 years. He's got a projected time frame for 5 years to finish this painting. And then once he's finished with it, then his intention is to travel and to teach, kind of using the Tonka, the painting, as a means for teaching. And that was one of the questions I had, was the artwork that I had been doing, or the painting I had been doing, how to actually use that as a means of sort of communicating meditation about Buddhism, or truth. And up to this point, I think I've always just, I really just trying to hone a skill, trying to learn a skill, and hadn't taken it beyond that aspect. So there's a whole new evolution is starting to form. And then even in that initial process, I've always been kind of fascinated by that, the aspect of just learning a new skill, and seeing that the very close ties with that, with what we're doing with meditation, learning from one medium, one aspect of our life, informs everything that we do, how well we do the duties and responsibilities that we have in the monastery, when you put effort and care and attention into all the smaller details of our life here, that those then have consequences with our meditation, has consequences with our mind states, and ultimately our ability to understand and to see the three characteristics and in our ability to let go. So it's how we see our resistance, see our defilements, and a lot of that is in the paying attention to the details. And so here it's learning to look after each other. Part of that starts off within the training of just learning to take care of ourselves. So we start off with right now the community is that lives here, the resident community, is spending a lot more time studying what we call the Vinaya, the monastic code. And so going through, and I think we haven't so far, but I think later on we're going to get into things like etiquette and some of the duties and responsibilities we have around the monastery. So there can be, and there is generally in forest monasteries, this real emphasis on how we take care of our cabins, what needs to be cleaned, how often we should clean it, how we clean it, how you take care of the cleaning rags and the tools that you use, brooms, rakes, just keeping them in good order, in good shape, keeping them in a nice, tidy and order spot in the monastery, so it's not cluttering up the monastery. And so just little things like this, can be quite easy just to, nobody ever comes to my cabin but me, and I don't care what it looks like, so I'll just let it go. But there's this real training to kind of go against our our defilements and our say baser mind states, and just learn to bring in some energy, to bring in some lightness and effort in that way. And then so then you know, we have other rules around our clothing, how we take care of our robes, what kind of shape they're in. If we do get a tear in them, how do we patch them? There's all these like really detailed minor rules, and a lot of it's just learning to pay attention to small details and to take care of ourselves first. And then in the beginning part of the training, then there's duties and responsibilities and learning to take care of each other. And like say the Anagarikas, they learn that really quickly right away because they'll be responsible for like the kitchen, a lot of the driving, handling money, transporting the senior monks or other community members who have maybe medical issues, things like that. So it's this real service-oriented kind of position, the Anagarikas, and almost everybody here, at least everybody here who's, you know, Ajahn Pasano is their teacher and is here as a monk, you know, who ordained with Ajahn Pasano as our preceptor. We've all gone through that aspect of the training, the Anagarika training. But then even once you start to become a junior monk, oftentimes we'll be assigned what's called being an upatak, which is looking after a senior monk or our visiting elders that come. So like we just had Ajahn Sumedho here, the senior monk in the Ajahn Chah lineage, came over from Thailand for a couple of weeks. And so two of the monks were probably volunteered to look after him. And so you're just trying to anticipate, you know, all the different aspects of what could be helpful for him. You know, you try to find out, pay attention to, you know, their particular habits. You try to pay attention in meetings, like, you know, they're going to be going to a particular meeting or they're going to be going to a particular teaching. And so you have to learn how to see things from somebody else's perspective, learn how to... Yeah, pay attention to these things, and then put forth the effort to you know, just the same way that you would care for yourself and your own belongings and your own kutis, and to learn then to start to do that for somebody else as well. So it's a sort of deepening of the training, to going from, you know, learning how to take care of yourself to learning how to take care of others. And, you know, in doing that, you know, if you do it with the right attitude, the right perspective, you know, it is sort of geared towards lightening the mind. Because when you are taking care of somebody else, then sometimes there's a lot of, you have to let go of your own priorities. You have to let go of, you know, like, yeah, this is what I want to do. But, oh, yeah, but I do have this duty, this responsibility. So it can teach you to let go, to prioritize things in a way that's not self-centered, but it's maybe more community-centered, more geared towards harmony and being helpful. And if you take it, you know, the duties and responsibilities in this way, it does create this lightness in the mind and brightness. And then when we, you know, turn to our meditation object or have time to be quiet and peaceful in the monastery, Lumbor talks about this a lot. It's also like, say, lack of regret. And when you sit down, there's more joy in the mind. Like, oh, you know, I've did my duties well. I've taken care of other people. I know other people are appreciative of the things that I've done. So there's happiness and lightness. And so that's a foundation for deepening the meditation practice. One of the aspects of the being at the icon workshop that I hadn't really thought a whole lot about in terms of, say, like the paintings that I've been doing or even the direction I want to go in is the is called, just, you know, the tradition of icon painting. You know, up to this point I've had ideas in my mind and exploring various things in the Buddhist world. I mentioned this last time. It's like there's actually none of the artwork that I've seen really kind of speaks to me. It's like I have an appreciation for Tibetan artwork. I have respect for the Thai paintings and styles like that. But it's nothing that is really familiar with to me, or even understanding what all the imagery is. And even like, say, the Thai ascetics, I've seen, you know, progressions of artwork, especially like carvings and things, and they'll do these really intricate carvings in wood. And I'll see the images when they're in the wood, and I'll think it's absolutely beautiful. And then they gold leaf it, and they paint it red. And it's just like, you know, to me, it's just like they completely destroyed it. Because it's just the absolute last thing in the world that I would do. But I understand the, you know, the imagery, the symbology of it. And a lot of the times it's, you know, it's not about aesthetics, even if... Even if the Thai artist, you know, thought it was absolutely beautiful, just as the wood carving, you know, there's conditions behind, you know, what the gold means, what the red means. Like, I remember when I was in Thailand, the main Buddha image at Wat Pa Nanachat had this extremely large head on the image, and I always thought it was just not grotesque, but it just was not a pleasing image to. For me to sort of sit in front of and to bring, you know, sort of peaceful mind states, always kind of judgmental by this about this Buddha image. And then when I was there, the abbot had some offerings made, and I guess I'm not exactly sure the whole story, but it was decided to gold leaf the Buddha image. And the first thing that they did to do that, because before it was just this very large brass, I think it's like 8 feet tall, 10 feet tall image, and they weren't going to gold leaf it. And so the first thing that you have to do is you have to put some sort of like an automotive paint on a primer. And this primer was this kind of grayish, light green color. And they painted it on there. And I had been away, so I didn't know like any of this was going to happen. And I came into the hall just as they had sort of finished that. And they had taped over the eyes, so the and then when they had painted it, so I came in and it just looked like just the color of it looked like granite to me. When I came in the hall, it just looked like this solid stone carved Buddha image, and it was absolutely beautiful. In my mind, I was just like, "Wow, that's absolutely beautiful." And then I was like, "You know, what'd they do with the old Buddha image?" And I'm like, no, that is the same. that's you know, it's the same one, but just changing the color of it, you know, completely. You know, I didn't see the head as being way too big. It just sort of made it feel like it was really earthy and heavy, and I just found this most beautiful image. And I started asking around, and about half of the monks loved it. They just thought it was really nice, and the other half they preferred it the way it was, or wanted to see it as gold. And there was a lot of people that actually wanted to leave it that way. And I think we took a vote, and it was like, I think there was one more person there that wanted to keep it green than that wanted to go gold leaf. So then the abbot sent all the monks that wanted to keep it green, sent them away, and then took the vote again. But I actually realized at the time that he was actually right, because, for Western aesthetics, you know, maybe that was, you know, it was more beautiful being the sort of, you know, green color. But whoever was the abbot of that monastery, because it was in Thailand, and he was dealing with Thai aesthetics and Thai, you know, views and opinions. Like every single person that seemed like that came into the monastery, their first question was, "Why is your Buddha image green?" You know, so it was just this. Westerners may have thought it was beautiful, but it was going to be a point of contention for most of the people coming there. You know, so the aesthetics aren't always what's the most important aspect of the image. Father Damien, during the icon workshop, was, you know, bringing this up that actually he didn't talk about it too much, but he gave us this kind of sheet of paper, kind of essay. It was a long essay on icons and kind of history and the kind of the theory behind it. And I guess I was reading it in there that you could see this in happening in the workshop was that. You know, I guess one of the reasons that, you know, icons work is because it does come from a particular tradition. When you're working as a painter, I don't know if you'd actually say an artist, but you probably would, but, you know, painter, in doing, a Christian icon, it's interesting that in that particular tradition, and I'm exploring it more sort of like in Tibetan and the Thai anyway, is that, you know, especially in the Tibetan, there's already this sort of really well thought out sort of, you know, sort of pantheon of images, and sort of they've already worked out the, say, the aesthetics of what an image actually looks like, maybe even, you know, color schemes, and the symbols has already been thought out and planned, and that's very much the case in the Christian icons as well. You know, I think it's actually like, you know, to be a true kind of Christian icon, you know, like you would be taking an image that's already existed. So like you wouldn't be totally doing anything, you know, completely new. You might have a different sort of interpretation or different colors or slightly different schemes, but you wouldn't be, you know, coming up with, I think, new imagery. I might be wrong on that, but you're coming from an already existing, the images are already there. And of course, most of them are of Jesus or of Mary and various saints, and occasionally will be teachers, abbots of particular monasteries, or abbesses maybe. And so they, you know, it's a very, there's a tradition in that as, of the imagery, but then also of the painting style itself and how you do the painting. And what I discovered was that in the workshop there were 10 of us that were doing the workshop, and there was a Christian monk visiting from a monastery near Chico, and he had already done a few icon paintings, and there was a woman there from, I don't say where she was from, but she was an art teacher, so she was a like a professional artist, and then there were two people there that I do not think could have drawn a straight line if their life depended on it. But most of us were working with the same icon. So for Father Damien, I think he would have preferred that all of us were working from the same icon, but different personalities. People had to do their own thing and had to do their own icon. But ideally, like, he would have been teaching 10 of us using the same icon. And I found out later why, because it's like he's sort of progressively taking us through the steps, teaching us how to do it. And he was the one sort of mixing up the colors and stuff like that. But if he had people working on three different images, he was three times as busy sort of making up the paints and trying to troubleshoot things in different ways. But if we were all working on the same image, it was easier. But anyway, most of us were working from the same image. And it was quite fascinating to go around and look at everybody's icons as we were working on them, because it was the tradition. So it was like we were given basically it was one image, and you could do a mirror image of it, one with the image facing right or one facing left, and one was the archangel, is it Michael, is that the one you did? And then I did the Gabriel. So it was these two images. It was the same image but just sort of reversed, and so all of us were working from those same images. And as you walked around and looked at everybody's, even the people that couldn't draw a straight line, you could definitely, you know, say like, oh, this one's, you know, say, you know, maybe technically more precise, or, you know, the shading or the blending is more beautiful, or more skillful maybe. But all of the images were actually beautiful. It was really striking to me that even those that, you know, couldn't draw the straight line, that the images were manifesting, they were coming out. And I saw that as because of the tradition. You know, it's like we were given a form, you know, very much like the monastic form or the Vinaya, and you know, just learning to fill in the details of our life, of working with those images, that something beautiful will come out of it. You know, like we may be quite judgmental about ourselves, like, you know, my cabin's a mess, or I don't do this duty very well, or you know, I want to be able to do that, but I, you know, there's this hindrance is in the way, and we can, you know, get down on ourselves and judgmental and think, okay, well, I just shouldn't do that, or I shouldn't take on that duty or responsibility and let somebody else do it. But you know, I think just, you know, wherever we are, just sort of plugging in and, you know, filling out that tradition, you know, as best we can with the tools that we have and the teachers that we have to help us, it does produce a really beautiful result. And I could see that happening, you know, physically manifesting in the icon painting. talking a little bit more about the workshop, I really loved the process of the way Father Damien does the icons. So far for myself, I've just used cotton cloth, and I have this what he kept calling plastic paints, like acrylics or fabric paint, and I kind of just started working with it because my mother had purchased a set of these paints for me, and then slowly I started learning how to match the colors and get colors that I like. So it's just a system that I know how to work with, and so I've kind of stuck with it, and not 100% satisfied with that, but I haven't explored outside of that. So doing this workshop, the process is so he goes right back from the beginning of their tradition. So it's working on wood panels that have been built up with some type of primer, and sketching or sort of using a stylus sort of pen to scratch in the image into the gessoed surface, and then using it's a egg tempora. So using the yellow part of the yolk of the egg, and then mixing that with a little bit of vinegar. There's a particular method you do it with, and then just mixing in raw pigments. And it turns out he said one of the best suppliers of pigments in the entire United States is in Willits. And so he gets his pigments from Willits. But as he was pointing out, that it's really kind of besides the using of the egg, it's a little bit, it's not a vegan process, but everything else, even with the egg, everything's it's completely natural. So it's like you're using, there's particular wood for the panels, and so it's like if you're a real icon painter, you'd be, you'd start from working with selecting the wood, getting the right types of wood, making sure it's well planed and fitting them together, and then the whole process of putting the primer on. I guess it's all, I haven't had that teaching transmission yet, but Father Damien he's offered me to teach me from square one with this whole process if I'm interested, if I have the time. So everything that goes into it, all of that is all completely natural, and then the all the pigments come straight from the earth, and say the egg. And then, as he was pointing out, it's like a lot of people when they hear about that, say, well, isn't that gonna fade, really, really quickly? Isn't that a bad way of doing it? And he's like, a lot of the icon paintings, they're like 600-800 year old paintings that are done in the style, and they're holding up, extremely, extremely well. His always, when he's teasing people about this, he says, well, if you're worried about how well an egg is going to stick, he says, let's go out to your car and we'll throw a bunch of eggs on it and see what happens. And he says, probably that egg is going to be on your car much longer than the paint on your car. It's extremely, extremely good sort of bonding. So, well, I think I liked about this, though, is this all completely natural, kind of being a forest, not kind of, but being a forest monk, that whole aspect of this is all coming right from nature, and mixing and making actually everything that you're doing. And then the first thing we did is when we were given the image, so for me it was Gabriel. What I do for myself when I'm working with an image is I have a light box that I've created in my cabin. So I'll have an image that I like, and we'll set that on top of the light box, then have the canvas that I'm working on top of that, and then can sketch out into whatever detail I need onto the canvas, and then it's sort of using that as the template, as the image. But you can't do that so much with the icon. So his method of doing it would be to, you have the image and you put a piece of tracing paper over it, and then you trace the image that you want, and then you turn it over, the tracing paper over, and then you draw it again, the reverse image of it, in a bit, say darker lines, and you did use a very soft sort of graphite, and so you're drawing the image twice, and then you flip it back over, and then you put that image on top of the the prepared surface, and then you sort of press it in, and that pushes just a little bit of the graphite onto the board, and then you have your image on there. And that has, you know, the practical advantage of leaving the image onto the board. But he said also it's kind of like a psychological aspect of it is that you're already starting to contemplate the image. So you've chosen the image, you've been looking at it, and then when you first draw it the very first time onto the tracing paper, you know, when you're doing that, it's like, you know, all the visual, you know, stimulus that we're taking, you're paying attention, you're using your concentration, and in some parts of our mind, especially if we're focused on what we're doing and being mindful, you know, that's making an impression on the mind. And it's interesting, the doing it backwards, doing the reverse. And I wonder if there's something, you know, psychological about that as well, just sort of seeing the reverse side of that. And so he said, you know, the idea for an icon painter is to, you know, that when they choose an image that they're painting, is that it's actually not at all for the aesthetics. You know, you're not doing it because you want to create a beautiful image. But for the artists themselves, it is a meditation. And so you would be choosing a particular icon that you wanted to paint, partly because that's maybe a quality or an aspect of yourself that you wanted to contemplate or you wanted to work on. And so as you're choosing a particular image, you know, the spiritual significance of that image, you know, like, so why would you be doing, you know, Gabriel versus Michael? I don't know the significance of the different images in that tradition, but you would know that if you were an icon painter, and you'd be contemplating that in your mind. And they have this, it actually came up during one of the beautiful things about our being there at the icon workshop was that myself and the other monk, as we went to all of their services, so we went to the morning, afternoon, evening services, and did all the chanting and as much as we could, you know, with them as well. And so one of the things, yeah, it was even came up during that service, you know, one of the services is that, you know, using the painting as a meditation, is that you know, it's like, you know, what we have in our mind, what we're thinking about, what we're contemplating, is to bring that from our mind, from our intellect, into our heart, and then, you know, once we've, you know, sort of, and that's to me sort of like more living that quality. It's like, you know, it's easy to do chanting and, you know, talk about the Brahma Viharas and loving kindness, and then, you know, go out and start yelling at somebody, you know, but it's you know, intellectually there, like we can understand that it's good to be peaceful, it's good to be helpful, but it's learning how to take those concepts and pull it into our heart and have that be how we live, not just what we value, but how we live those qualities. So this is the same thing with the icon painter. He said you've chosen your image, and you're actually contemplating. It's not so much, you know, you're not trying just to fill in the colors and fill in the spaces, but you're, while you're doing it, you're contemplating it. And they said, you know, a really skilled icon painter, one that they say you can actually really actually see it in the painting. So someone who's really sort of, you know, like, is full of compassion, you know, if they've been working on this, you know, for years, you can actually see it in the icon. You know, like, so someone who's maybe known for being very compassionate and is doing an icon that's you know, that image is about compassion, like it would be seen. But maybe if the same person, same artist, didn't have, you know, like, say, wisdom wasn't their forte, like, you know, maybe that aspect wouldn't show up in their icon, but you could see it in the one with compassion. And I have gut feeling, or I could, you know, really get a sense that can be true. Another aspect of the icon painting that was kind of fun was, and I've been contemplating this too in terms of say meditation practice as well, is that say every time you start a new piece of artwork, is you're starting from scratch. So it's like you do have all of the knowledge and all of the the history, and it's actually your memory. You know, it's an aspect of memory, is, you know, how the colors look, how you mix them, what things you've done in the past that worked, what didn't work, and so you're bringing up, you know, all of these qualities, these memories. But yet when you start, you've got a completely blank slate. And so it's this great reminder for starting fresh, you know, every single time. Like, you know, it can be difficult to do that, but like every single meditation we sit down, you know, like if we assume that we already know everything there is to know about meditation, or, you know, we've already got this mastered, then, you know, there's probably lots of things we're missing. There's lots of things we could be learning, lots of maybe even things that we do know that we're, you know, not bringing into the meditation because we're not seeing it fresh, we're not seeing it new. So there's that. I like that aspect, and, you know, contemplating that every time I, you know, pull out a new piece of canvas, you know, I'm always intrigued. Like, you know, I might have an idea of what I'm going to do, but, you know, it's like, you know, I always wonder, like, what am I going to learn from this? Oftentimes, you know, some of the most beautiful aspects or way you learn is by accidents. You know, just trying something slightly different, or maybe trying to do something the exact same way, but it comes out differently. It's contemplating, well, why? How did that happen? Where did that come from? So it's just, you know, learning how to learn. So with the icon painting, I loved it. So once you've sort of scratched the image onto the icon, I think at this point you actually did a dedication, a really strong sort of, what's your intention behind doing the icon? It was like we did a meditation kind of prayer almost of, you know, dedicating merit. Icons in the Christian tradition are supposed to have healing powers, and so it's like you might be thinking of, you know, a particular person you wanted to give the icon to, or just in general, this icon would be like in a church or a place of worship that you'd want it to have this particular quality to it, and so the artist would actually spend some time just with the whiteboard with the image just sort of scratched into it, and really put your wholesome intentions and thoughts into that image, the pre-image. And then once you've done that, then I'm not sure if this is Father Damien's sense of humor or not, but the first thing you do is you put this sort of gray, very light, almost like watercolor wash on the surface of it. And I think it does have a practical purpose of it helps the egg tempora to then to stick to the board better, but it's called chaos. So when you start before you start bringing out the image, you're starting from not just a blank slate for the beginning, but you're actually starting from chaos. And so this we're stuck in samsara, we're in dukkha. And so there's this, you know, the chaos on the board, and it does kind of look like this cloud, you know, swirling sort of mess. And then with the icon, it's really beautiful that you start from the darkest colors of your icon, and then you work from dark to light. And as you're working on the, say, like the face or the image, the more, you know, that you keep going to the light and light and light, you're the face. Actually, I was totally amazed that in this process, because I've never been considered myself to be very skilled at sort of portrait paintings, but just following the instructions and, you know, keeping into the tradition, just, you know, keep bringing in these lighter colors. It's totally amazing how this face, you know, sort of, you know, very strongly, you know, appears out of this, out of what was, you know, chaos. And a couple of interesting things about icon painting that I'd never known. Again, Christian icon paintings, never had a strong attraction to them. Again, because it's they're not really designed to be an ascetic experience in terms of like how we would view Western art. But when Father Damien was explaining to us, you know, like, I was asking him questions about, he had some of his own artwork, his own icons that he was working on there, and was working on them when we weren't asking him questions. And I was noticing little details about, you know, why this was that way and things. And so he started, you know, as a professor would, sort of explaining to us. And, well, one thing is in an icon, there's no shadows. And so the image actually appears, and it's and when you look at it in that, with this kind of understanding, you can see this, is that the light isn't like, say, like, you know, these photographs that are up on the wall. You know, the light that you see, we know that that's reflected light. You know, we've seen enough photos, we've seen enough people that, you know, there's an external light that's hitting the side of the face, hitting the nose, and that's why we see things three-dimensionally. But in an icon painting, the image of the angel or the saint, the light is coming from inside the being and coming out. And so there is no shadow. You know, like a light bulb itself has no shadow, because it's, the light is coming out of it. And so when you look at an icon in the same way, that's what you're seeing. So the sort of psychological, sort of spiritual quality of this is that you say you are on the outside looking at this image in this, you know, sort of like it's the prototype. It's, you know, like, say, compassion maybe is the, like, what you are aspiring towards, what you're venerating, what you're, you know, the quality that you want to develop, and it's in this particular being, physically manifested in this being, and it comes through in many ways. So one of that is the light is coming from inside the being, and like the images that we were painting, at first I was looking at them, I was like, you know, they're very naive, you know, sort of drawings or paintings, because the eyes were like these, you know, like almond kind of shaped eyes. The pupils are really dilated, and that's why I was questioning that. And again, this is that image of the light coming, you know, the being in the painting itself is sort of like, say, an enlightened being, or is somebody who's has that quality. So they're in the lightness, and you're in the darkness. And so it's like if someone is coming from a light room going into a dark room, with their, if you, as soon as you do that, your eye dilates. And so the image of that is this being is coming from the light into your world, is coming into your world. Another aspect of the icon that I really thought was quite beautiful was that, say, in Western art, like when I was, you know, an art student, I remember them kind of looking at icon paintings and sort of making fun of the fact that they didn't understand perspective. You know, they make it a big thing of in the Renaissance, when artists started painting things in vanishing perspective, where if you're drawing a picture of a road going off in the distance, and it had a fence along the side of it, the fence post closest to you in the painting would be, you know, three feet tall, and as they go into the distance, they get smaller and smaller till they're only like just a couple of inches tall, and that gives you the perspective that, you know, the horizon line is way off in the distance, and that and what this does is it draws the eye into the canvas, and the sort of the vanishing point of the canvas is actually sort of the image is behind the image. But when you start looking at a Christian icon, they do all these, the perspective is, it's called reverse perspective. And so, like, I noticed it initially in pictures of, like, with saints, if they're holding a book or something, the images, like, will be like the open page will be, you know, the size of a normal page, but then as the pages get closer to you, they get bigger. They get smaller. I forget exactly how it goes, but the perspective is instead of going, say, into the picture, the perspective is that it goes, vanishes. The vanishing point is in front of the canvas, and so instead of having the vanishing point be, you know, behind, the vanishing point is in front. And so psychologically, what this does is it actually takes you out of the picture. You know, instead of drawing you in, it has this reverse, you know, and you start seeing it as, you know, that quality, or that they call the prototype of the icon image is what's important. It's not that you're not important, but it has this, it's actually sort of like the self-view, the self-perceptions, all the self-concerns are become less and less and less because, you know, the image is what takes on the significance. And you know, partly it's being trained into how to view an icon. And then when you do that, so the artist, there's, you know, I see, you know, great benefits in the artist painting and, you know, learning to manifest these qualities in themselves so that, you know, that they, you know, they learn and it changes their, you know, they're learning in while they're painting. But also in the viewing of the icon, there's a, you know, being part of the church service was quite beautiful that, I didn't actually realize this till I got back here and started again reading up a little bit more on the icons. But the whole church service when we were there was really focused on their icons. When there's a particular icon just in, like, you'd come in and there'd be a table and there's an icon on it, and everybody who is, you know, part of the church and is ordained into that, or even the lay people who are practicing that particular way, and they come in and they sort of, you know, do the cross but they'd bow down and they'd kiss the icon. So there's this, you know, physical kissing of the icon, and there'd be certain times where during the services they might bring an icon out and everybody would go up and actually physically kiss the icon. So there's this veneration, you know, paying respects to that. And then in other points there'd be a lighting of candles. One of the monks would come out and in front of various icons that were important to their church, they have little candles or oil lamps, and so they light these the candles in front of the particular icons. And then at the end of the service, before the service is over, they go and put them out. And several times during the service, the cantor would come out and it's called scenting. They would scent all of the icons. So it's this big thing of, you know, burning incense. And we would go around and would do the individuals, but also would do the icons. So there are many, many different ways of venerating and, you know, paying respects to the icons. And it was just a different form of meditation, different form of devotional aspect than we find, you know, normal, or how we pay respects and how we venerate. You know, there wasn't any bowing, you know, in that church. I think they would come here and find that very strange. So we might find it kind of, you know, weird, sort of kissing an icon. But when they understand the significance and why they're doing that, it can bring on a really beautiful quality, can bring up beautiful aspects of training, of understanding. So just real kind of quickly, just kind of wrapping up, since I've been back, so I was just on retreat for 2 weeks, and I actually had to hold myself back. So I was like limiting myself to like 6 hours of painting a day, and basically six in the afternoon till midnight would be my time I allowed myself to paint. And it's interesting, like, 'cause I've changed a little bit as soon as I came back, and just seeing these the icons as being light images. I had remembered when we were in the state of Washington, we visited Shravasti Abbey, and I asked Beth when she was there if she'd take a photograph of this one Tonka painting. I just thought it was absolutely beautiful, and so Beth took a few photographs of it and came back, and I started reading up about it, and it's white Tara is the image, and Tara is a light being. He's not white. It's supposed to be light. So I thought, well, that's quite interesting. And I really liked the image, so I started doing a few paintings of that image. And I can give a whole other Dhamma talk on that, using that. But it's way more detailed than anything else that I've ever painted before. And I've always been afraid of getting into too much detail, and for various reasons. But I found it was just totally absorbing of the mind, the concentration that comes in trying to pay attention to these details. And then I've also been really afraid of more of the Thai kind of artwork with all the flames and swirls and nagas and dragons and things. And so after doing a couple of these actually about 10 paintings of Tara, and feeling really comfortable or seeing the benefit of really paying attention to those details. Just the last couple of days, I've tried a couple of paintings more in the Thai style and really enjoying it. And I'm noticing this morning was kind of contemplate was, you know, like, why is that? And I think it is the, you know, using the artwork right now in that aspect is just the amount of concentration that it takes. It really brings the mind into this, say, one pointedness, because you do have to be mixing colors and paying attention to other things. So it's not the same as you know, sitting on a cushion, focusing on one particular aspect. It's just interesting to me that, you know, having been to that one workshop and, you know, learning different techniques and learning, you know, how they approach the art and why they approach it in a particular way, you know, has already started to change, you know, just the way I'm looking at that. And hopefully, you know, that'll change, it'll have, you know, effects in not just my artwork, but also in say, monastic life and in spiritual practice in general. Say, after not having talked for 2 weeks, it's amazing that I'm not going to go on for 3 hours, so I'll end this talk at this point.